Side 5, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 193. The man in the black doublet moved his horse in closer, rose in his stirrups, and knocked his son from the saddle with a solid blow of his fist. Then he turned to face Keurig.
"My apologies, Sir Knight," he said. "My half-wit son didn't know to whom he was speaking. I revere the church and honor her knights. I hope and pray that you were not offended."
"Not at all, my lord," Keurig said easily. "Your son and I had very nearly resolved our differences." The noble winced.
"Thank God I arrived in time, then. That idiot isn't much of a son, but his mother would have been distressed if you'd been obliged to cut off his head."
"I doubt that it would have gone that far, my lord."
"Father!"
the young man on the ground said in horrified shock.
"You hit me!"
There was blood streaming from his nose.
"I'm going to tell Mother."
"Good. I'm sure she'll be very impressed."
The noble looked apologetically at Keurig.
"Excuse me, Sir Knight. I think some long overdue discipline is in order."
He glared at his son.
"Return home, Jochen," he said coldly. "When you get there, pack up this covey of parasitic wastrels and send them away. I want them off the estate by sundown."
"But they're my friends,"
his son wailed.
"Well, they're not mine. Get rid of them. You will also pack. Don't bother to take fine clothing, because you're going to a monastery. The brothers there are very strict, and they'll see to your education, which I seem to have neglected."
"Mother won't let you do that,"
his son exclaimed, his face going very pale.
"She doesn't have anything to say about it. Your mother has never been more to me than a minor inconvenience."
"But..."
the young brat's face seemed to disintegrate.
"You sicken me, Jochen. You're the worst excuse for a son a man has ever been cursed with. Pay close attention to the monks, Jochen. I have some nephews far more worthy than you. Your inheritance is not all that secure, and you could be a monk for the remainder of your life."
"You can't do that."
"Yes, actually, I can."
"Mother will punish you."
The noble's laugh was chilling.
"Your mother has begun to tire me, Jochen," he said. "She's self-indulgent, shrewish, and more than a little stupid. She's turned you into something I'd rather not look at. Besides, she's not very attractive anymore. I think I'll send her to a nunnery for the rest of her life. The prayer and fasting may bring her closer to heaven. And the amendment of her spirit is my duty as a loving husband, wouldn't you say?"
The sneer had slid off Jochen's face, and he began to shake violently as his world crashed down around his ears.
"Now, my son," the noble continued disdainfully, "will you do as I tell you, or shall I unleash this knight of the church to administer the chastisement you so richly deserve?"
Keurig took his cue from that and slowly drew Bavier's sword. It made a singularly unpleasant sound as it slid from its sheath. The young man scrambled away on his hands and knees.
"I have a dozen friends with me," he threatened shrilly.
Keurig looked the pampered boys up and down, then he spat derisively.
"So," he said, shifting his shield and flexing his sword arm.
"Did you want to keep his head, my lord?" he asked the noble politely.
"As a keepsake, naturally."
"You wouldn't!"
Jochen was very nearly in a state of collapse now. Keurig moved his horse forward, his sword glinting ominously in the sunlight.
"Try me," he said, in a tone dreadful enough to make the very rocks shrink.
The young man's eyes bulged in horror, and he scrambled back into his saddle with his satin-dressed sycophants rushing along behind him. "Was that more or less what you had in mind, my lord?" Keurig asked the noble.
"It was perfect, Sir Knight. I've wanted to do that myself for years."
Then he sighed.
"Mine was an arranged marriage, Sir Knight," he said by way of explanation. "My wife's family had a noble title, but they were deeply in debt. My family had money and land, but our title was not impressive. Our parents felt that the arrangement was sound, but she and I scarcely speak to one another. I've avoided her whenever possible. I've solaced myself with other women, I'm ashamed to admit. There are many accommodating young ladies, if one has the price. My wife's solaced herself with that abomination you just saw. She has few other enthusiasms, aside from making my life as miserable as she possibly can. I've neglected my duties, I'm afraid. I have sons myself, my lord, Curic told him as they all rode on. Most of them are good boys, but one has been a great disappointment to me. Talon rolled his eyes heavenward, but didn't say anything. Do you travel far, Sir Knight? The noble asked, obviously wanting to change the subject. We go toward Veni, Curic replied. A journey of some distance. I have a summer house near the west end of my estate. Might I offer you its comfort? We should reach it by evening, and the servants there can see to your needs. He made a wry face. I'd offer you the hospitality of the manor, but I'm afraid tonight may be a bit noisy there. My wife has a penetrating voice, and she's not going to take kindly to certain decisions I've made this afternoon. You're most kind, my lord. We'll be happy to accept your hospitality. It's the least I can do in recompense for my son's behavior. I wish I could think of some appropriate form of discipline to salvage him. I've always gotten good results with a leather belt, my lord, Curic suggested. The nobleman laughed wryly. That might not be a bad idea, Sir Knight, he agreed. They rode on through a lovely afternoon, and as the sun was just going down, they reached the summer house, which appeared to be only slightly less opulent than a mansion. The nobleman gave instructions to the household servants and then remounted his horse. I'd gladly stay, Sir Knight, he said to Curic, but I think I'd better get back home before my wife breaks every dish in the house. I'll find a comfortable cloister for her and live out my life in peace. I quite understand, my lord, Curic replied. Good luck. Godspeed, Sir Knight. And the noble turned and rode back the way they had come. Curic, Xavier said gravely as they entered the marble-floored foyer of the house. You did honor to my armor back there. I'd have had my sword through that young fellow after his second remark. Curic grinned at him. It was much more fun this way, Sir Xavier. The Pelosian noble's summer house was even more splendid in the inside than it had appeared from the exterior. Rare woods, exquisitely carved, paneled the walls. The floors and fireplaces were all of marble, and the furnishings were covered with the finest brocade. The serving staff was efficient and unobtrusive, and they saw to every need. Sparhawk and his friends dined splendidly in a dining room only slightly smaller than a grand ballroom. Now this is what I call living, Carlton sighed contentedly. Sparhawk, why is it that we can't have a bit more luxury in our lives? We're knights of the church, Sparhawk reminded him. Poverty toughens us up. But do we have to have so much of it? How are you feeling? Sophrania asked Xavier. Much better, thanks, the Arshan replied. I haven't coughed up any blood since this morning. I think I'll be up to a canter tomorrow, Sparhawk. This leisurely stroll is costing us time. Let's go easy for one more day, Sparhawk said. According to my map, the country beyond the city of Veni is a little rugged and very underpopulated. It's ideal for ambushes, and we're being followed. I want you and Carlton and Tinian fit to defend yourselves. Beirut?
Yes?
Would you do me a favor before we leave here?
Of course.
First thing in the morning, take Talon out into the courtyard and search him, thoroughly. The noble who owns this place was very hospitable, and I don't want to offend him.
What makes you think I'd steal anything?
Talon objected. What makes me think you wouldn't? It's just a precaution. There are a great number of small, valuable things in this house. Some of them might just accidentally find their way into your pockets. The beds in the house were down-filled, and they were deep and comfortable. They rose at dawn and ate a splendid breakfast. Then they thanked the servants, mounted their waiting horses, and rode on out. The new-risen sun was golden, and larks whirled and sang overhead. Flute, sitting in the wagon, accompanied them on her pipes. Sophrania seemed stronger, but at Sparhawk's insistence she still rode in the wagon. It was shortly before noon when a group of perhaps 50 fierce-looking men came galloping over a nearby hill. They were booted and dressed in leather, and their heads were all shaved. Tribesmen from the eastern marches, Tinian, who had been in Pelosia before, warned. Be very careful, Sparhawk. These are reckless men. The tribesmen swooped down the hill with superb horsemanship. They had savage-looking sabers at their belts, carried short lances, and wore round shields on their left arms. At a curt signal from their leader, most of them reined in so sharply that their horses' rumps skidded on the grass. With 5 cohorts, the leader, a lean man with narrow eyes and a scarred scalp, came forward. With ostentatious display, the advancing tribesmen moved their horses sideways, the proud stallions prancing in perfect unison. Then, plunging their lances into the earth, the warriors drew their flashing sabers with a grand flourish. "No!" Tinian said sharply, as Sparhawk and the others instinctively went for their swords. "This is a ceremony. Stand fast." The shaved-headed men came forward at a stately walk, and then at some hidden signal, their horses all went down on their front knees in a kind of genuflection, as the riders raised their sabers to their faces in salute.
"Lord," Carlton breathed, "I've never seen a horse do that before."
Farron's ears flicked, and Sparhawk could feel him twitching irritably.
"Hail, Knights of the Church," the leather-garbed leader intoned formally. "We salute you and stand at your service."
"Can I handle this?" Tinian suggested to Sparhawk. "I've had some experience."
"Feel free, Tinian," Sparhawk agreed, eyeing the pack of savage men on the hill.
Tinian moved forward, holding his black horse in tightly so that its pace was measured and slow.
"Gladly we greet the Piloi," the Daeran declaimed formally. "Glad also are we of this meeting, for brothers should always greet each other with respect."
"You know our ways, Sir Knight," the scar-headed man approved.
"I have been in times past on the Eastern Marches, Domi," Tinian acknowledged.
"What's Domi mean?" Carlton whispered.
"An ancient Pelosian word," Ulith supplied. "It means chief, sort of."
"Sort of?"
"It takes a long time to translate."
"Will you take salt with me, Sir Knight?" the warrior asked.
"Gladly, Domi," Tinian replied, stepping slowly down from his saddle.
"And might we season it with well-roasted mutton?" he suggested.
"An excellent suggestion, Sir Knight."
"Get it," Sparhawk said to Talon. "It's in that green pack, and don't argue."
"I'd sooner bite out my tongue,"
Talon agreed nervously, digging into the pack.
"Warm day, isn't it?"
the Domi said conversationally, sitting cross-legged on the lush turf.
"We were saying the same thing just a few minutes ago," Tinian agreed, also sitting.
"I am Kring," the scarred man introduced himself. "Domi of this band."
"I am Tinian," the Daeran replied, "an Alcyone knight. I surmised as much."
Talon went a bit hesitantly to where the two men sat, carrying a roast leg of lamb.
"Well-prepared meat,"
Kring proclaimed, unhooking a leather bag of salt from his belt.
"The knights of the church eat well."
He ripped the lamb roast in two with teeth and fingernails and handed half to Tinian. Then he held out his leather bag.
"Salt, brother," he offered.
Tinian dipped his fingers into the bag, took out a generous pinch, and sifted it over his lamb. Then he shook his fingers in the direction of the four winds.
"You are well versed in our ways, friend Tinian," the Domi approved, imitating the gesture.
"And is this excellent young fellow perhaps your son?"
"Ah, no, Domi," Tinian sighed. "He's a good lad, but he's addicted to thievery."
"Ho, ho," Kring laughed, fetching Talon a clap on the shoulder that sent the boy rolling. "Thievery is the second most honorable profession in the world, next to fighting. Are you any good, boy?"
Talon smiled thinly, and his eyes went narrow.
"Would you care to try me, Domi?" he challenged, coming to his feet. "Protect what you can, and I'll steal the rest."
The warrior rolled back his head, roaring with laughter. Talon, Sparhawk noticed, was already close to him, his hands moving fast.
"All right, my young thief," the Domi chortled, holding his widespread hands out in front of him. "Steal what you can."
"Thank you all the same, Domi," Talon said with a polite bow, "but I already have. I believe I've got just about everything of value you own."
Kring blinked and began to pat himself here and there, his eyes filled with consternation.
Curic groaned. "It may turn out all right after all," Sparhawk muttered to him.
"Two brooches," Talon catalogued, handing them over. "7 rings. The one on your left thumb is really tight, you know. A gold bracelet. Have that checked. I think there's brass mixed with it. A ruby pendant. I hope you didn't pay too much for it. It's really an inferior stone, you know. Then there's this jeweled dagger and the pommel stone off your sword."
Talon brushed his hands together professionally.
The Domi roared with laughter. "I'll buy this boy, friend Tinian," he declared. "I'll give you a herd of the finest horses for him and raise him as my own son.
Such a thief I've never seen before. Sorry, friend Kring, Tinian apologized, but he's not mine to sell.
Kring sighed. Could you even steal horses, boy? He asked wistfully.
A horse is a little hard to fit in your pocket, Domi, Talon replied. I could probably work it out, though.
A lad of genius, the warrior said reverently. His father is a man of great fortune.
I hadn't noticed that very much, Keurig muttered.
A young thief, Kring said almost regretfully. I seem to be also missing a purse, a fairly heavy one.
Oh, did I forget that? Talon said, slapping his forehead. It must have completely slipped my mind.
He fished a bulging leather bag out from under his tunic and handed it over.
Count it, friend Kring, Tinian warned. Since the boy and I are now friends, I will trust his integrity.
Talon sighed and fished a large number of silver coins out of various hiding places.
I wish people wouldn't do that, he said, handing the coins over. It takes all the fun out of it.
Two herds of horses? The Domi offered.
Sorry, my friend, Tinian said regretfully. Let us take salt and talk of affairs.
The two sat eating their salted lamb as Talon wandered back to the wagon.
He should have taken the horses, he muttered to Sparhawk. I could have slipped away just after dark.
He'd have chained you to a tree, Sparhawk told him.
I can wriggle my way out of any chain in less than a minute. Do you have any idea of how much horses like he's got are worth, Sparhawk?
Training this boy may take longer than we'd expected, Carlton noted.
Will you require an escort, friend Tinian? Kring was asking.
We are engaged in no more than a slight diversion, and we will gladly put it aside to assist our Holy Mother Church and her revered knights.
Thank you, friend Kring, Tinian declined, but our mission involves nothing we can't deal with.
Truly, the prowess of the Knights of the Church is legendary.
What is this diversion you mentioned, Domi? Tinian asked curiously. Seldom have I seen the Paloi this far west.
We normally haunt the eastern marches, Kring admitted, ripping a large chunk of lamb off the bone with his teeth. But from time to time over the past few generations, Zamoks have been trying to slip across the border into Pelosia. The king pays a gold half-crown for their ears. It's an easy way to make money.
Does the king demand both ears?
No, just the right ones. We still have to be careful with our sabers, though. You can lose the whole bounty with a misaimed stroke. Anyway, my friends and I flushed a fair-sized group of Zamoks near the border. We took a number of them, but the rest fled. They were coming this way last we saw them, and some were wounded. Blood leaves a good trail. We'll run them down and collect their ears and the gold. It's just a question of time.
I think I might be able to save you a bit of that, my friend, Tinian said with a broad smile. From time to time in the last day or so, we've seen a fairly large party of Zamoks riding to our rear. It might just be that they're the ones you're seeking. In any case, though, an ear is an ear, and the king's gold spends just as sweetly, even if it chances to be mistakenly dispensed.
Kring laughed delightedly.
It does indeed, friend Tinian, he agreed. And who knows? It could just be that there are two bags of gold available out here.
How many are they, would you say?
We've seen 40 or so.
They're coming up the road from the south.
They won't come much farther, Kring promised, grinning a wolf-like grin.
This was indeed a fortunate meeting, Sir Tinian, at least for me and my comrades. But why didn't you and your companions turn around and collect the bounty?
We weren't really aware of the bounty, Domi, Tinian confessed, and we're on church business of some urgency.
He made a wry face.
Besides, even if we did gain that bounty, our oaths would require that we hand it over to the church. Some fat abbot somewhere would profit from our labors. I don't propose to sweat that much to enrich a man who's never done an honest day's work in his life. I'd far rather point a friend in the direction of honest gain.
Impulsively, Kring embraced him.
My brother, he said, you are a true friend. It's an honor to have met you.
The honor is mine, Domi, Tinian said gravely.
The Domi wiped his greasy fingers on his leather breeches.
Well, I suppose we should be on our way, friend Tinian, he said. Slow riding earns no bounty.
He paused. Are you sure you don't want to sell that boy?
He's the son of a friend of mine, Tinian said. I wouldn't mind getting rid of the boy, but the friendship's valuable to me.
I understand perfectly, friend Tinian.
Kring bowed. Commend me to God next time you talk with him. He vaulted into his saddle from a standing start, and his horse was running before he was even settled. Ulith walked up to Tinian and gravely shook his hand.
You're fast on your feet, he observed. That was absolutely brilliant.
It was a fair trade, Tinian said modestly. We get the Zaymarks off our backs, and Kring gets the ears. No bargain between friends is fair unless both sides get something they want.
Very, very true, Ulith agreed. I've never heard of selling ears before, though. Usually it's heads.
Ears are lighter, Tinian said professionally, and they don't stare at you every time you open your saddlebags.
Would you gentlemen mind, Sophrania said tartly. We have children with us after all.
Sorry, little mother, Ulith apologized easily. Just talking shop.
She stalked back to the wagon, muttering. Sparhawk was fairly certain that some of the styric words she was saying under her breath were never used in polite society.
Who were they? Xavier asked, looking at the warriors who were rapidly disappearing toward the south.
They're of the Poloi, Tinian replied. Nomadic horse herders. They were the first Alenes in this region. The kingdom of Pelosia is named after them.
Are they as fierce as they look?
Even fiercer. Their presence on the border was probably why Otha invaded Lamarkand instead of Pelosia. No one in his right mind attacks the Poloi. They reached Lake Veni late the following day. It was a large, shallow body of water into which nearby peat bogs continually drained, making the water turbid and brown-stained. Flute seemed strangely agitated as they made camp some distance back from the marshy lake shore. As soon as Sophrania's tent was erected, she darted inside and refused to come out.
What's the matter with her?
Sparhawk asked Sophrania, absently rubbing the ring finger on his left hand. It seemed to be throbbing for some reason.
I really don't know, Sophrania frowned. It's almost as if she's afraid of something.
After they had eaten and Sophrania had carried Flute's supper into her, Sparhawk closely questioned each of his injured companions. They all claimed perfect health, a claim he was sure was spurious.
All right, then. He gave up, finally. We'll go back to doing it the old way. You gentlemen can have your armor back, and we'll try a canter tomorrow. No galloping, no running. And if we run into any trouble, try to hold back unless things get serious.
He's just like an old mother hen, isn't he? Calton observed to Tinian.
If he scratches up a worm, you get to eat it, Tinian replied.
Thanks all the same, Tinian, Calton declined, but I've already had my supper. Sparhawk went to bed. It was about midnight, and the moon was very bright outside the tent. Sparhawk sat bolt upright in his blankets, jolted awake by a hideous roaring bellow.
Sparhawk, Ulith said sharply from outside the tent. Rouse the others, fast!
Sparhawk shook Calton awake and pulled on his mail shirt. He grabbed up his sword and ducked out of the tent. He looked around quickly and saw that the others needed no rousing. They were already struggling into their mail and were taking up weapons. Ulith stood at the edge of camp, his round shield in place and his axe in his hand. He was looking off intently into the darkness. Sparhawk joined him.
What is it? He asked quietly.
What makes a noise like that?
Troll, Ulith replied shortly.
Here? In Pelosia?
Ulith, that's impossible. There aren't any trolls in Pelosia.
Why don't you go out there and explain that to him?
Are you absolutely sure it's a troll? I've heard that sound too many times to miss it. It's a troll, all right, and he's absolutely enraged about something.
Maybe we should build up the fire, Sparhawk suggested as the others joined them.
It wouldn't do any good, Ulith said. Trolls aren't afraid of fire.
You know their language, don't you?
Ulith grunted.
Why don't you call to him and tell him that we mean him no harm?
Sparhawk, Ulith said with a pained look. In this situation, it's the other way around. If he attacks, try to strike at his legs, he warned them all. If you swing at his body, he'll jerk your weapons out of your hands and feed them to you.
All right, I'll try to talk with him. He lifted his head and bellowed something in a horrid, guttural language. Something out there in the darkness replied, snarling and spitting.
What did it say? Sparhawk asked. He's cursing. It may take him an hour or so to get finished. Trolls have a lot of swear words in their language.
Yuleth frowned.
He doesn't really seem all that sure of himself, he said, sounding puzzled.
Perhaps our numbers are making it cautious,
Xavier suggested.
They don't know what the word means, Yuleth disagreed. I've seen a lone troll attack a walled city.
There was another snarling bellow from out in the darkness, this time a little closer.
Now what's that supposed to mean?
Yuleth said in bafflement.
What? Sparhawk asked.
He's demanding that we turn the thief over to him.
Talon?
I don't know.
How could Talon pick a troll's pocket?
They don't have pockets. Then they heard the sound of flute's pipes coming from Sophrania's tent. Her melody was stern and vaguely threatening. After a moment, the beast out in the darkness howled, a sound partially of pain and partially of frustration. Then the howling faded off into the distance.
Why don't we all go to Sophrania's tent and kiss that little girl about the head and shoulders for a while?
Yuleth suggested.
What happened? Calton asked.
Somehow she ran him off.
I've never seen a troll run from anything.
I saw one try to attack an avalanche once.
I think we'd better talk with Sophrania.
Something's going on here that I don't understand. Sophrania, however, was as puzzled as they. She was holding flute in her arms, and the little girl was crying.
Please, gentlemen, the Styric woman said softly, just leave her alone for now. She's very, very upset.
I'll stand watch with you, Yuleth, Tinian said as they came out of the tent. That bellow froze my blood. I'll never get back to sleep now. They reached the city of Veni 2 days later. Once the troll had been frightened away, they neither saw nor heard any further sign of him. Veni was not a very attractive city, because local taxes were based on the number of square feet on the ground floor of each house. The citizens had circumvented the law by building overhanging second stories. In most cases, the overhang was so extreme that the streets were like narrow, dark tunnels, even at noon. They put up at the cleanest inn they could find, and Sparhawk took Keurig and went in search of information. For some reason, however, the word Gossic made the citizens of Veni very nervous. The answers Sparhawk and Keurig received were vague and contradictory, and the citizens usually went away from them very fast.
Over there, Keurig said shortly, pointing at a man staggering from the door of a tavern. He's too drunk to run.
Sparhawk looked critically at the reeling man.
He could also be too drunk to talk, he added.
Keurig's methods, however, were brutally direct. He crossed the street, seized the drunkard by the scruff of the neck, dragged him to the end of the street, and shoved his head into the fountain that stood there.
Now then, he said pleasantly, I think we understand each other. I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to give me the answers, unless you can figure out a way to sprout gills.
The fellow was spluttering and coughing. Keurig pounded on his back until the paroxysms passed.
All right, Keurig said. The first question is, where is Gossic?
The drunken man's face went pasty white and his eyes bulged in horror. Keurig shoved his head under water again.
This is starting to make me very tired, he said conversationally to Sparhawk, looking across the bubbles coming up out of the fountain.
He pulled the fellow out by the hair.
This isn't going to get any more enjoyable, friend, he warned. I really think you ought to start to cooperate. Let's try again. Where is Gossic?
The north,
the fellow choked, spewing water all over the street.
He seemed to be almost sober now.
We know that. Which road do we take?
Go out the north gate. A mile or so after you get out of town, the road branches. Take the left fork.
You're doing fine. See, you're even staying sort of dry. How far is it to Gossic?
About 40 leagues.
The man writhed in Keurig's iron grip.
Last question, Keurig promised. Why does everybody in Veni wet himself whenever he hears the name Gossic?
It's a horrible place. Things happen there that are too hideous to describe.
I've got a strong stomach, Keurig assured him. Go ahead, shock me.
They drink blood up there and bathe in it, and even feed on human flesh. It's the most awful place in the world. Even to mention its name brings down a curse on your head. The man shuddered and began to weep.
"There, there," Keurig said, releasing him and patting him gently on the shoulder.
He gave the man a coin.
"You seem to have gotten all wet, friend," he added. "Why don't you go back to the tavern and see if you can get dry?"
The fellow scurried off.
"Doesn't sound like too pleasant a place, does it?" Keurig said.
"No, not really," Sparhawk admitted. "But we're going there all the same."
Chapter 13. Because the road they proposed to follow was reputed not to be very good, they arranged to leave the wagon with the innkeeper and rode out on horseback the next morning through shadowy streets illuminated by torches. Sparhawk had passed on the information Keurig had wrung out of the drunken man the day before, and they all looked around warily as they passed out through the north gate of Veni.
"It's probably just some local superstition," Colton scoffed. "I've heard awful stories about places before, and they usually turned out to be about things that had happened generations before."
"It doesn't really make much sense," Sparhawk agreed. "That tanner back in Parlor said that Count Gossick's a scholar. That's not usually the sort of man who goes in for exotic entertainments. Let's stay alert, anyway. We're a long way from home, and it might be a little hard to call in help."
"I'll hold back a bit," Barrett volunteered. "I think we'd all feel better if we're sure those Zamoks aren't still trailing us."
"I think we can count on the Domi's efficiency," Tinian said. "Still," Barrett said.
"Go ahead, Barrett," Sparhawk agreed. "It's just as well not to take chances."
They rode at an easy canter. As the sun was rising, they reached the fork in the road. The left fork was rutted, narrow, and poorly maintained. The rain that had swept through the area for some days back had left it muddy and generally unpleasant, and thick brush lined both sides of it.
"It's going to be slow going," Euleth noted. "I've seen smoother roads, and it's not going to get better once we get up into those hills."
He looked toward the low range of forested mountains lying just ahead.
"We'll do the best we can," Sparhawk said. "But you're right. 40 leagues is quite a distance, and a bad road isn't going to make it seem any shorter."
They started up the muddy road at a trot. As Euleth had predicted, it grew steadily worse. After about an hour, they entered the forest. The trees were evergreens, and they cast a somber shade, but the air was cool and damp, a welcome relief for the armored knights. They stopped briefly for a meal of bread and cheese at noon, and then pressed on, climbing higher and higher into the mountains. The region was ominously deserted, and even most of the birds seemed muted, the only exception being the sooty ravens who seemed to croak from every tree. As evening began to settle over the gloomy wood, Sparhawk led the others some distance away from the road, and they made camp for the night. The dismal forest had subdued even the irrepressible Colton, and they were all very quiet as they ate their evening meal. After they had eaten, they went to their beds. It was about midnight when Euleth woke Sparhawk to take his turn on watch.
"There seem to be a lot of wolves out there," the big Genidian said quietly. "It might not be a bad idea to put your back to a tree."
"I've never heard of a wolf attacking a man," Sparhawk replied, also speaking softly to avoid waking the others.
"They usually don't," Euleth agreed, "unless they're rabid."
"That's a cheerful thought. I'm glad you liked it.
I'm going to bed. It's been a long day."
Sparhawk left the circle of firelight and stopped about 50 yards back in the forest to allow his eyes to adjust to the darkness. He heard the howling of wolves back off in the woods. He thought he had found the source of many of the stories that had been circulating about Gossick. This gloomy forest alone would be sufficient to stir up the fears and superstitious people. Add to that the flocks of ravens, always a bird of ill omen, and the chill howling of packs of wolves, and it was easy to see how the stories had gotten started. Sparhawk carefully circled the camp, his eyes and ears alert. 40 leagues. Given the worsening condition of the road, it would be unlikely that they could cover more than 10 leagues a day. Sparhawk chafed at their slow pace, but there was nothing he could do about it. They had to go to Gossick. The thought came to him that the Count might very well not have found anyone who knew the whereabouts of King Sarek's grave, and that this tedious and time-consuming trek might all be for nothing. He quickly pushed that thought out of his mind.
Idly, still watching the surrounding woods, he began to wonder what his life would be like if they were successful in curing Alana. He had known her only as a child, but she was no longer a little girl. He had received a few hints about her adult personality, but nothing definite enough to make him feel that he really knew her. She would be a good queen, of that he was certain. But exactly what kind of a woman was she? He saw a movement out in the shadows and stopped, his hand going to his sword as he searched the darkness. Then he saw a pair of blazing green eyes that reflected back the light of their fire. It was a wolf. The animal stared at the flames for a long time, then turned to slink silently back into the forest. Sparhawk realized that he had been holding his breath, and he let it out explosively. No one is ever really prepared for a meeting with a wolf, and even though he knew it was irrational, he nonetheless felt the instinctive chill. The moon rose, casting its pale light over the dark forest. Sparhawk looked up and saw the clouds coming in. Gradually, they obscured the moon. It inexorably continued to build up. "Oh, fine," he muttered. "That's all we need. More rain." He shook his head and walked on, his eyes probing the darkness around him. Somewhat later, Tinian relieved him and he went back to his tent. "Sparhawk!" It was Talon, and his shaking of Sparhawk's shoulder was light as he woke the big Pandion. "Yes?" Sparhawk sat up, recognizing the note of urgency in the boy's voice.
"There's something out there."
"I know. Wolves."
"This wasn't a wolf, unless they've learned to walk on their hind legs."
"What did you see?"
"It was back in the shadows under those trees. I couldn't see it very well, but it seemed to have a kind of robe over it, and the robe didn't fit very well."
"The Seeker?"
"How would I know? I only caught a glimpse of it. It came to the edge of the woods and then dropped back into the shadows. I probably wouldn't even have seen it except for the glow coming off its face."
"Green?" Talon nodded. Sparhawk started to swear.
"When you run out of words, let me know," Talon offered. "I'm a pretty good swearer."
"Did you warn Tinian?"
"Yes."
"What were you doing out of bed?" Talon sighed.
"Grow up, Sparhawk,"
he said in a tone far older than his years.
"No thief ever sleeps more than 2 hours at a time without going to look around."
"I didn't know that."
"You should have. It's a nervous life, but it's a lot of fun."
Sparhawk cupped his hand about the back of the young fellow's neck. "I'm going to make a normal boy out of you yet," he said.
"Why bother? I outgrew all that a long time ago. It might have been nice to run and play, if things had been different, but they weren't, and this is much more fun." "Go back to sleep, Sparhawk. Tinian and I'll keep an eye on things. Oh, by the way, it's going to rain tomorrow."
But it was not raining the following morning, though murky clouds obscured the sky. About mid-afternoon, Sparhawk reined Farron in.
"What's the trouble?" Curic asked him.
"There's a village down there in that little valley. What could they possibly be doing out here in these woods? You can't farm with all these trees in the way."
"We could ask them, I suppose.
I want to talk with them anyway. They're closer to Gossick than the people back in Venny were, and I'd like to get a little more up-to-date information. There's no point in riding into something blind if you don't have to." "Colton," he called.
"Now what?" Colton demanded.
"Take the others and keep on going. Curic and I are going down to that village to ask a few questions. We'll catch up with you."
"All right."
Colton's tone was abrupt and slightly surly.
"What's the matter?"
"These woods depress me."
"They're only trees, Colton."
"I know, but do there have to be so many of them?"
"Keep your eyes open. That Seeker's out there someplace."
Colton's eyes brightened. He drew his sword and tested its edge with his thumb.
"What have you got in mind?" Sparhawk asked him. "This might just be the chance we've been waiting for to get that thing off our backs once and for all. Otha's bug is very skinny. One good stroke should cut it in two. I think I'll just hang back a little bit and set up an ambush of my own."
Sparhawk thought very quickly at that point.
"Nice plan," he seemed to agree. "But someone has to lead the others to safety."
"Tinian can do that."
"Maybe.
But do you feel like trusting Sophronia's well-being to somebody we've only known for 6 months and who's still recovering from an injury?
Calton called his friend a number of obscene names.
Duty, my friend, Sparhawk said calmly. Duty. Its stern call pulls us away from various entertainments. Just do as I asked you to do, Calton. We'll take care of the Seeker later.
Calton continued to swear. Then he wheeled his horse and rode off to join the others.
You were right on the edge of a fight there, Curic commented.
I noticed that.
Calton's a good man in a fight, but he's a hothead sometimes.
Then the two of them turned their horses and rode on down the hill toward the village.
The houses were made of logs, and they had sod roofs. The villagers had made some effort to clear the trees surrounding their community, creating stump-dotted fields extending perhaps 100 paces back from their houses.
They've cleared the land, Curic observed, but about all I see are kitchen gardens. I still wonder what they're doing out here.
That question was answered as soon as they rode into the place. A number of villagers were laboriously sawing boards from logs lying atop crude trestles. Stacks of warped green lumber beside the houses explained the purpose of the village. One of the men stopped sawing, mopping at his brow with a dirty rag.
"There's no inn here," he said to Sparhawk in an unfriendly tone.
"We're not looking for an inn, neighbor," Sparhawk said. "Just some information. How much farther is it to the house of Count Gossick?"
The villager's face went slightly pale.
"Not far enough away to suit me, my lord,"
he replied, eyeing the big man in black armor nervously.
"What's the trouble, friend?" Curic asked him.
"No sensible man goes near Gossick," the villager replied. "Most people don't even want to talk about it."
"We heard some of the same sort of thing back in Venny," Sparhawk said. "What's going on at the Count's house, anyway?"
"I couldn't really say, my lord," the man said evasively. "I've never been there. I've heard some stories, though."
"Oh?"
"People have been disappearing around here. They're never seen again, so nobody really knows for sure what happened to them. The Count's serfs have been running away, though, and he's not reputed to be a hard master. Something evil is going on in his house, and all the people who live nearby are terrified."
"Do you think the Count's responsible?"
"It's not very likely. The Count's been away from home for the past year. He travels around a lot."
"We heard that about him."
Sparhawk thought of something.
"Tell me, neighbor, have you seen any Styrix lately?"
"Styrix? No, they don't come into this forest. People up here don't like them, and we make the fact well known."
"I see. How far did you say it is to the Count's house?"
"I didn't say. It's about 15 leagues, though."
"A fellow in Venny said that it was 40 leagues from there to Gossick," Curic told him.
The villager snorted derisively.
"City folk don't even know how far a league is. It can't be much over 30 from Venny to Gossick."
"We happened to see somebody back in the woods last night," Curic said in a mildly conversational tone. "He was wearing a black robe and had his hood up. Could that have been one of your neighbors?"
The sawyer's face went very, very pale.
"Nobody around here wears that kind of clothes," he said shortly.
"Are you sure?"
"You heard me. I said nobody in this district dresses like that."
"It must have been some traveler, then."
"That must be it."
The villager's tone had become unfriendly again, and his eyes were a little wild.
"Thank you for your time, neighbor," Sparhawk said, turning Farron around to leave the village.
"He knows more than he's saying," Curic observed as the two of them were passing the last houses.
"Right," Sparhawk agreed. "The Seeker doesn't own him, but he's very, very much afraid. Let's move right along. I want to catch up with the others before dark."
They overtook their friends just as the sky to the west took on the ruddy glow of sunset, and they made camp beside a silent mountain lake not far from the road.
"You think it's going to rain?" Calton asked after they had eaten supper and were sitting around the fire.
"Don't say that," Talon said. "I only just got dry from all that rain in Lammercand."
"It's always possible, of course," Curic said in reply to Colton's question. "It's the time of year for it. But I don't smell very much moisture in the air.
Spirit came back from where they had picketed the horses.
"Sir Sparhawk," he said quietly, "there's somebody coming."
Sparhawk came to his feet.
"How many?"
"I only heard one horse. Whoever it is coming down the road from the direction we're going."
The novice paused.
"He's pushing his horse very hard," he added.
"That's not too wise," Euloth grunted, "considering the dark and the condition of that road."
"Should we put out the fire?" Bavier asked.
"I think he's already seen it, Sir Bavier," Bavier replied.
"Let's see if he decides to stop," Sparhawk said.
"One man all by himself isn't much of a threat."
"Unless it's the Seeker," Keurig said, shaking out his chain mace.
"All right, gentlemen," he said in his gruff drill sergeant's voice. "Spread out and get ready."
The knights automatically responded to that note of command. They all instinctively recognized the fact that Keurig probably knew more about close fighting than any man in the four orders. Sparhawk drew his sword, suddenly feeling an enormous pride in his friend. The traveler reined in his horse on the road not too far from their camp. They could all hear the horse panting and gasping for breath.
"May I approach?"
the man out in the darkness pleaded. His voice was shrill and seemed to hover on the very brink of hysteria.
"Come on in, stranger," Carlton replied easily after a quick glance at Keurig.
The man who came riding out of the darkness was flamboyantly, even gaudily, dressed. He wore a wide-brimmed plumed hat, a red satin doublet, blue hose, and knee-length leather boots. He had a lute slung across his back. Except for a small dagger at his waist, he carried no weapons. His horse lurched and staggered with exhaustion, and the rider himself appeared to be in much the same condition.
"Thank God,"
the man said when he saw the armored knight standing around the fire. He swayed dangerously in his saddle and would have fallen had not Bavier jumped forward to catch him.
"The poor fellow seems to be just about played out," Carlton said. "I wonder what's chasing him."
"Wolves, maybe," Tinian shrugged. "I expect he'll tell us just as soon as he gets his breath."
"Get him some water, Talon," Sophronia instructed.
"Yes, ma'am."
The boy took a pail and went down to the lake.
"Just lie back for a few moments," Xavier told the stranger. "You're safe now."
"There's no time,"
the man gasped.
"There's something of vital urgency I must tell you."
"What's your name, friend?" Carlton asked him.
"I am Arbaly, a minstrel by profession," the stranger replied. "I write poetry and compose the songs I sing for the entertainment of lords and ladies. I have just come from the house of that monster Count Gossick."
"That doesn't sound too promising," Euloth muttered.
Talon brought the pail of water, and Arbaly drank greedily.
"Take his horse down to the lake," Sparhawk told the boy. "Don't let him drink too much right at first."
"Right,"
Talon said.
"Why do you call the Count a monster?" Sparhawk asked then.
"What else would you call a man who seals up a fair damsel in a tower?"
"Who is this fair damsel?" Xavier asked, his voice strangely intent.
"His own sister,"
Arbaly choked in a tone of outrage.
"A lady incapable of wrongdoing."
"Did he happen to tell you why?" Tinian asked.
"He rambled out some nonsense, accusing her of foul misdeeds. I refused to listen to him."
"Are you sure about this?" Carlton's tone was skeptical. "Did you ever see the lady?"
"Well, no, not really. But the Count's servants told me about her. They said that she's the greatest beauty in the district, and that the Count sealed her in that tower when he returned from a journey. He drove me and all the servants from the castle, and now he proposes to keep his sister in that tower for the rest of her life."
"Monstrous!" Xavier exclaimed, his eyes afire with indignation.
Sophronia had been watching the minstrel very closely. "Sparhawk," she said urgently, motioning him away from the fire. The two of them walked off, and Keurig followed them.
"What is it?" Sparhawk asked once they were out of earshot.
"Don't touch him," she replied, "and warn the others to avoid him as well."
"I don't quite follow."
"Something's wrong with him, Sparhawk," Keurig said. "His eyes aren't right, and he's talking a little too fast."
"He's infected with something," Sophronia said.
"A disease?"
Sparhawk shuddered back from the word. In a world where plagues were rampant, that word rang in human imagination like the clap of doom.
"Not in the sense you mean," she replied.
This is not a physical disease. Something has contaminated his mind, something evil.
The Seeker?
I don't think so. The symptoms aren't the same. I've got a strong feeling that he might be contagious, so keep everybody away from him.
He's talking, Keurig said, and he doesn't have that wooden face. I think you're right, Sophronia. I don't believe it's the Seeker. It's something else.
He's very dangerous just now, she said.
Not for long, Keurig said bleakly, reaching for his mace.
Oh, Keurig, she said in a resigned tone of voice. Stop that. What would Asladi say if she found out you were assaulting helpless travelers?
We really don't have to tell her, Sophronia.
When will the day come when Aline stopped thinking with their weapons? She said in exasperation.
Then she said something in Styric that Sparhawk did not recognize. I beg your pardon, he said.
Never mind.
There's a problem, though, Keurig said seriously. If the minstrel's infectious, then Bavier's got it, too. He touched him when he fell off his horse.
I'll keep an eye on Bavier, she said. Perhaps his armor protected him. I'll know better in a little while.
And Talon? Sparhawk asked. Did he touch the minstrel when he brought in that pail of water?
I don't think so, she said.
Could you cure Bavier if he's caught it? Keurig asked.
I don't even know what it is yet. All I know is that something has taken possession of that minstrel.
Let's go back and try to keep the others away from him.
I charge you, knights of the church, the minstrel was saying in strident tones. Ride forthwith to the house of the wicked count. Punish him for his cruelty and free his beautiful sister from her undeserved punishment.
Yes,
Bavier said fervently. Sparhawk looked quickly at Sophronia, and she gravely nodded to advise him that Bavier had been infected.
Stay with him, Bavier, he told the Arshan. The rest of you come with me.
They walked a short distance from the fire, and Sophronia quietly explained.
And now Bavier's got it too? Calton asked her.
I'm afraid so. He's already beginning to behave irrationally.
Talon, Sparhawk said seriously, when you gave him that pail of water, did you touch him?
I don't think so, the boy replied.
Are you feeling any urges to run around rescuing ladies in distress? Keurig asked him.
Me? Keurig, be serious. He's all right, Sophronia said with a sound of relief in her voice.
All right, Sparhawk said. What do we do?
We ride to Gossick as quickly as we can, she replied. I have to find out what's causing the infection before I can cure it. We absolutely have to get into that castle, even if it involves force.
We can handle that, Ulith said. But what are we going to do about that minstrel? If he can infect others just by touching them, he's likely to come back at the head of an army.
There's a simple way to deal with it, Calton said, putting his hand on his sword hilt.
No, Sophronia said sharply. I'll put him to sleep instead. A few days' rest might do him some good anyway.
She looked sternly at Calton.
Why is your first answer to any problem always a sword?
Overtrained, I guess. He shrugged.
Sophronia began to speak the incantation, weaving the spell with her fingers and quietly releasing it.
What about Bavier? Tinian asked. Wouldn't it be a good idea for him to go to sleep, too?
She shook her head. He has to be able to ride. We can't leave him behind. Just don't get close enough to him to let him touch you. I've got problems enough already.
They walked back to the fire.
The poor fellow's gone to sleep, Bavier reported. What are we going to do about this?
Tomorrow morning we're going to ride on to Gossick, Sparhawk replied.
Oh, one thing, Bavier, he added. I know you're outraged about this, but try to keep your emotions under control when we get there. Keep your hand away from your sword and keep your tongue under control. Let's feel this situation out before we take any action.
That's the course of prudence, I suppose, Bavier admitted grudgingly. I'll feign illness when we get there. I'm not sure I could restrain my anger if I have to look this monstrous count in the face too many times.
Good idea, Sparhawk agreed. Put a blanket over our friend here and then get to bed. Tomorrow's going to be a hard day.
After Bavier had gone to his tent, Sparhawk spoke quietly with his fellow knights.
"Don't wake Bavier to stand watch tonight," he cautioned. "I don't want him getting any ideas about riding out on his own in the middle of the night." They all nodded and went to their blankets. It was still cloudy the following morning, a dense gray overcast that filled the dismal wood with a kind of murky twilight. After they had finished breakfast, Keurig erected a sheet of canvas on poles over the sleeping minstrel.
"Just in case it rains," he said.
"Is he all right?" Xavier asked.
"Just exhausted," Sophronia replied evasively. "Let him sleep." They mounted and rode back out to the rutted track. Sparhawk led them at first at a trot to warm up the horses, and then, after about a half hour, he pushed Farron into a gallop.
"Keep your eyes on the road," he shouted to the others. "Let's not cripple any of the horses."
They rode hard through the murky wood, slowing briefly from time to time to rest their mounts. As the day progressed, they began to hear rumbles of thunder off to the west, and the impending storm increased their desire to reach the questionable safety of the house at Gossick. As they drew closer to the Count's castle, they passed deserted villages that had fallen into ruin. The storm clouds roiled overhead, and the distant thunder marched steadily toward them. Late in the afternoon, they rounded a curve and saw the large castle perched atop a crag on the far side of a desolate field, where ruined houses stood huddled together as if fearful of the bleak structure glowering down at them. Sparhawk reined Farron in.
"Let's not just go charging up there," he said to the others. "We don't want the people in the castle to misunderstand our intentions."
He led them at a trot across the field. They passed the village and approached the base of the craggy hill. There was a narrow track leading up the side of the crag, and they rode up it in single file.
"Gloomy-looking place," Euroth said, craning his neck to look up at the brooding structure atop the crag.
"It doesn't really help to generate much enthusiasm for this visit," Colton agreed. The track they followed led ultimately to a barred gate. Sparhawk reined in, leaned over in his saddle, and pounded on the gate with one steel-clad fist. They waited, but nothing happened. Sparhawk pounded again. After some time, a small panel in the center of the gate slid open.
"What is it?"
a hollow voice demanded shortly.
"We are travelers," Sparhawk replied, "and we seek shelter from the storm which approaches."
"The house is closed to strangers."
"Open the gate," Sparhawk said flatly. "We are knights of the church, and failure to comply with our reasonable request for shelter is an offense against God."
The unseen man on the other side of the gate hesitated.
"I must ask the Count's permission," he said grudgingly in a deep, rumbling voice.
"Do so at once, then."
"Not a very promising beginning, is it?" Colton said. "Gatekeepers sometimes take themselves too seriously," Tinian told him. "Keys and locks do strange things to some people's sense of proportion." They waited, while lightning streaked the purple sky to the west. Then, after what seemed a very long time, they heard the rattling of a chain, followed by the sound of a heavy iron bar sliding through massive rings. Grudgingly, the gate groaned open. The man inside was huge. He wore bullhide armor, and his eyes were deep sunk beneath heavy brows. His lower jaw protruded, and his face was bleak. Sparhawk knew him. He had seen him once before. Chapter 14. The corridor into which the surly gate guard led them was draped with cobwebs and dimly lighted by flickering torches set in iron rings at widely spaced intervals. Sparhawk quite deliberately lagged behind to fall in beside Sophronia.
"You recognized him too?" he whispered to her.
She nodded. "There's more going on here than we realized," she whispered back. "Be very careful, Sparhawk. This is dangerous."
"Right," he grunted.
At the far end of the cobwebbed hallway stood a large, heavy door. When their silent escort pulled it open, the rusty hinges squealed in protest. They came out at the head of a curved stairway that led down into a very large room. The room was vaulted, its walls were painted white, and the polished stone floor was as black as night. A fire burned fitfully in the arched fireplace, and the only other light came from a single candle on the table before the fire. Seated at the table was a pale-faced, gray-haired man dressed all in black. His face was melancholy, and had the pallor of one who is seldom out in the sun. He looked somehow unhealthy, a victim of some obscure malaise. He was reading a large, leather-bound book by the light of his single candle.
"The people I spoke of, master," the lantern-jawed man in the bullhide armor said deferentially in his deep, hollow voice. "Very well, Okuda," the man at the table replied in a weary voice. "Prepare chambers for them. They will stay until the storm abates." "It shall be as you say, master."
The big servant turned and went back up the stairs.
"Very few people travel into this part of the kingdom," the man in black informed them. "The region is desolate and unpopulated. I am Count Garsic, and I offer you the meager shelter of my house until the weather clears. In time you may wish that you had not found my gate."
"My name is Sparhawk," the big Pandion told him, and then he introduced the others. Garsic nodded politely to each.
"Seat yourselves," he invited his guests. "Okuda will return shortly and prepare refreshments for you."
"You are very kind, my lord of Garsic," Sparhawk said, removing his helmet and gauntlets.
"You may not think so for long, Sir Sparhawk,"
Garsic said ominously. "That's the second time you've hinted at some kind of trouble within your walls, my lord," Tinian said.
"And it may not be the last, Sir Tinian. The word trouble, however, is far too mild, I'm afraid. To be quite honest with you, had you not been knights of the church, my gates would have remained closed to you. This is an unhappy house, and I do not willingly inflict its sorrows on strangers."
"We passed through Veni a few days ago, my lord," Sparhawk said carefully. "All manner of rumors are going about concerning your castle."
"I'm not in the least surprised," the Count replied, passing a trembling hand across his face. "Are you unwell, my lord?" Sophrenia asked him. "Advancing age, perhaps. And there's only one cure for that."
"We saw no other servants in your house, my lord," Davia said, obviously choosing his words carefully.
"Okuda and I are the only ones here now, Sir Davia."
"We encountered a minstrel in the forest, Count Garsic," Davia told him almost accusingly. "He mentioned the fact that you have a sister."
"You must mean the fool called Arbeli," the Count replied. "Yes, I do, in fact, have a sister."
"Will the lady be joining us?" Fabio's tone was sharp.
"No," the Count replied shortly. "My sister is indisposed."
"Lady Sophrenia here is highly skilled in the healing arts," Fabio pressed.
"My sister's malady is not susceptible to cure." The Count said it with a note of finality.
"That's enough, Bavier," Sparhawk told the young Cyrenic in a tone of command. Bavier flushed and rose from his chair to walk to the far end of the room.
"The young man seems distraught," the Count observed.
"The minstrel Arbeli told him some things about your house," Pinion said candidly. "Bavier's an Arshan, and they're an emotional people."
"I see," the melancholy nobleman replied. "I can imagine the kind of wild tales Arbeli is telling. Fortunately, few will believe him."
"I'm afraid you're in error, my lord," Sophrenia disagreed. "The tales Arbeli tells are a symptom of a disorder that clouds his reason, and the disorder is infectious. For a time at least, everyone he encounters will accept what he says as absolute truth."
"My sister's arm grows longer, I see."
From somewhere far back in the house there came a hideous shriek, followed by peal upon peal of mindless laughter.
"Your sister?" Sophrenia asked gently.
Garsic nodded, and Sparhawk could see the tears brimming in his eyes.
"And her malady is not physical?"
"No."
"Let us not pursue this further, gentlemen," Sophrenia said to the knights. "The subject is painful to the Count."
"You're very kind, madame," Garsic said gratefully.
He sighed, then said, "Tell me, Sir Knights, what brings you into this melancholy forest?"
"We came expressly to see you, my lord," Sparhawk told him.
"Me?"
The count looked surprised. "We are on a quest, Count Gossick. We seek the final resting place of King Sarek of Thalesia, who fell during the Zamok invasion."
"The name is vaguely familiar to me."
"I thought it might be. A tanner in the town of Pollar, a man named Baird."
"Yes, I know him."
"Anyway, he told us of the chronicle you're compiling." The count's eyes brightened, bringing life to his face for the first time since they had entered the room.
"The labor of a lifetime, Sir Sparhawk."
"So I understand, my lord. Baird told us that your research has been more or less exhaustive."
"Baird may be a bit overgenerous in that regard."
The count smiled modestly.
"I have, however, gathered most of the folklore in northern Pelosia, and even in some parts of Deira. Otha's invasion was far more extensive than is generally known."
"Yes, so we discovered. With your permission, we'd like to examine your chronicle for clues that might lead us to the place where King Sarek is buried."
"Certainly, Sir Sparhawk, and I'll help you myself. But the hour grows late, and my chronicle is weighty."
He smiled self-deprecatingly.
"Once I begin, we could be up for most of the night. I lose all track of time once I immerse myself in those pages. Suppose we wait until morning before we begin."
"As you wish, my lord." Then Acuda entered, bringing a large pot of thick stew and a stack of plates.
"I fed her, master,"
he said quietly.
"Is there any change?"
the count asked.
"No, master, I'm afraid not."
The count sighed, and his face became melancholy again. Arcuda's skills in the kitchen appeared to be limited. The stew he provided was marginal at best, but the count was so immersed in his studies that he appeared to be indifferent to what was set before him. After they had eaten, the count bade them good night, and Arcuda led them up the stairs and down a long corridor toward the rooms he had prepared. As they approached the chambers, they heard the shrieks of the madwoman once again. Xavier suppressed a sob. "She's suffering," he said in an anguished voice.
"No, Sir Knight," Acuda disagreed. "She's completely insane, and people in her condition cannot comprehend their circumstances."
"I'd be interested to know how a servant came to be such an expert in diseases of the mind." "That's enough, Xavier," Sparhawk said.
"No, Sir Knight,"
Acuda said.
"Your friend's question is pertinent."
He turned toward Xavier.
"In my youth, I was a monk,"
he said.
"My order devoted itself to caring for the infirm. One of our abbeys had been converted into a hospice for the deranged, and that's where I served. I have had much experience with the insane. Believe me when I tell you that Lady Bellina is hopelessly mad."
Xavier looked a little less certain of himself, but then his face hardened again.
"I don't believe you," he snapped.
"That's entirely up to you, Sir Knight," Acuda said. "This will be your chamber."
He opened the door.
"Sleep well."
Xavier went into the room and slammed the door behind him.
"You know that as soon as the house grows quiet, he'll go in search of the Count's sister, don't you?" Sophronia murmured.
"You're probably right," Sparhawk agreed. "Acuda, is there some way you can lock that door?" The huge Pelosian nodded.
"I can chain it shut, my lord," he said.
"You'd better do it, then. We don't want Xavier wandering around the halls in the middle of the night." Sparhawk thought a moment. "We'd better post a guard outside his door as well," he told the others. "He's got his Lochaber axe with him, and if he gets desperate enough, he might try to chop the door down."
"That could get a little tricky, Sparhawk," Colton said dubiously. "We don't want to hurt him, but we don't want him coming at us with that gruesome axe of his, either."
"If he tries to get out, we'll just have to overpower him," Sparhawk said. Acuda showed the others to their rooms, and Sparhawk's was the last.
"Will that be all, Sir Knight?"
the servant asked politely as they entered. "Stay a moment, Acuda," Sparhawk said.
"Yes, my lord."
"I've seen you before, you know."
"Me, my lord?"
I was in Kyrillos some time ago, and Sophronia and I were watching a house belonging to some Styrix. We saw you accompany a woman into that house. Was that Lady Bellina? Ocuda sighed and nodded. It was what happened in that house that drove her mad, you know.
I guessed as much.
Can you tell me the whole story? I don't want to bother the Count with painful questions, but we've got to rid Sir Bavier of his obsession.
I understand, my lord. My first loyalty is to the Count, but perhaps you should know the details. At least that way you may be able to protect yourselves from that madwoman.
Ocuda sat down, his rugged face mournful.
The Count is a scholarly man, Sir Knight, and he's frequently away from home for long periods, pursuing the stories he's been collecting for decades. His sister, Lady Bellina, is, or was, a plain, rather dumpy woman of middle years, with very little prospect of ever catching a husband. This is a remote and isolated house, and Bellina suffered from loneliness and boredom. Last winter she begged the Count to permit her to visit friends in Kyrillos, and he gave her his consent, provided that I accompany her.
I'd wondered how she got there, Sparhawk said, sitting on the edge of the bed.
Anyway, Ocuda continued, Bellina's friends in Kyrillos are giddy, senseless ladies, and they filled her ears with stories about a Styrix house where a woman's youth and beauty could be restored by magic. Bellina became inflamed with a wild desire to go to the house. Women do things for strange reasons sometimes.
Did she, in fact, grow younger?
I wasn't permitted to accompany her into the room where the Styrix magician was, so I can't say what happened in there. But when she came out, I scarcely recognized her. She had the body and face of a 16-year-old, but her eyes were dreadful. As I told your friend, I've worked with the insane before, so I recognized the signs. I bundled her up and brought her straight back to this house, hoping that I might be able to treat her here. The Count was away on one of his journeys, so he had no way of knowing what began to happen after I got her home.
And what was that? Ocuda shuddered.
It was horrible, Sir Knight, he said in a sick voice. Somehow she was able to dominate the other servants completely. It was as if they were powerless to resist her commands.
All except you.
I think the fact that I had been a monk may have protected me. Either that or she didn't think I was worth the trouble.
What exactly did she do?
Whatever it was that she encountered in that house in Kyrillos was totally evil, Sir Knight, and it possessed her utterly. She would send the servants who were her slaves out to surrounding villages by night, and they would abduct innocent serfs for her. I discovered later that she'd had a torture chamber set up in the cellar of this house. She gloried in blood and agonies.
Ocuda's face twisted with revulsion.
Sir Knight, she fed on human flesh and bathed her naked body in human blood. I saw her with my own eyes.
He paused and then continued.
It was no more than a week ago when the Count returned to the castle. It was late one night when he arrived, and he sent me to the cellar for a bottle of wine, though he seldom drinks anything but water. When I was down there, I heard what sounded like a scream. I went to investigate, and opened the door to her secret chamber. I wish to God I never had.
He covered his face with his hands, and a racking sob escaped him.
Bellina was naked,
he continued, after he had regained his composure,
and she had a serf girl chained down on a table. Sir Knight, she was cutting the poor girl to pieces while the girl was still alive, and she was cramming quivering pieces of flesh into her own mouth.
Ocuda made a retching sound, then clenched his teeth together. Sparhawk never knew what impelled him to ask the question. Was she alone in there?
No, my lord. The servants, who were her slaves, were there as well, lapping the blood from those dank stones. And...
The lantern-jawed man hesitated. Go on.
I cannot swear to this, my lord. My head was reeling. But it seemed that at the back of the chamber, there was a hooded figure all in black, and its presence chilled my soul.
Can you give me any details about it? Sparhawk asked.
Tall, very thin, totally enshrouded in a black robe.
And? Sparhawk pressed, knowing with icy certainty what came next.
The room was dark, my lord,
Okuda apologized.
Except for the fires in which Belina heated her torturing irons. But from that back corner I seemed to see a glow of green. Is that in any way significant?
It may be, Sparhawk replied bleakly. Go on with the story.
I ran to inform the Count. At first he refused to believe me, but I forced him to go to the cellar with me. I thought at first he would kill her when he saw what she was doing. Would to God that he had! She started screeching when she saw him in the doorway and tried to attack him with the knife she'd been using on the surf girl. But I wrested it from her.
Was that when he locked her in the tower? Sparhawk was shaken by the horrible story.
That was my idea, actually,
Okuda said grimly.
At the hospice where I served, the violent ones were always confined. We dragged her to the tower and I chained the door shut. She will remain there for the rest of her life if there's any way I can manage it.
What happened to the other servants?
At first they made attempts to free her, and I had to kill several of them. Then yesterday the Count heard a few of them telling a wild story to that silly fool of a minstrel. He instructed me to drive them all out of the castle. They milled around outside the gate for a while, and then they all ran off.
Was there anything strange about them?
They all had absolutely blank faces,
Akuta replied.
And the ones I killed died without making a sound.
I was afraid of that. We've encountered that before.
What happened to her in that house tonight? What drove her mad?
You've been trained as a monk, Akuta, Sparhawk said. So you've probably had some theological instruction. Are you familiar with the name Azash?
The god of the Zamoks?
That's him. The Styrix in that house in Kyrelos were Zamoks, and it's Azash who owns Lady Belina's soul. Is there any way she could possibly have gotten out of that tower?
Absolutely impossible, my lord.
Somehow she managed to infect that minstrel, and he was able to pass it on to Bavier.
She could not have gotten out of the tower, Sir Knight, Okuda said adamantly.
I'll need to talk with Sophrenia, Sparhawk said. Thank you for being so honest, Okuda.
I told you all this in the hope that you could help the Count.
Okuda rose to his feet. We'll do what we can.
Thank you. I'll go chain your friend's door shut.
He started toward the door, then turned back.
Sir Knight,
he said in a somber tone.
Do you think I should kill her? Might that not be better?
It may come to that, Akuta, Sparhawk said frankly. And if you do, you'll have to cut off her head. Otherwise, she'll just rise again.
I can do that if I have to. I have an axe, and I'll do anything to spare the Count more suffering.
Sparhawk put a comforting hand on the servant's shoulder. You're a good and true man, Okuda, he said. The Count's lucky to have you in his service.
Thank you, my lord.
Sparhawk removed his armor and went down the corridor to Sophrenia's door.
Yes,
she said in response to his knock.
It's me, Sophrenia, he said.
Come in, dear one,
she said. He entered her room. I had a talk with Okuda, he said.
Oh?
He told me what's been happening here. I'm not sure if you want to hear it.
If I'm to cure Bavier, I'm afraid I'll have to.
We were right, Sparhawk began. The Pelosian woman we saw going into that Zamok house in Kyrelos was the Count's sister.
I was sure of it. What else?
Briefly, Sparhawk repeated what Okuda had told him, glossing over the more gory details.
It's consistent, she said almost clinically. That form of sacrifice is a part of the worship of Azash.
There's more, Sparhawk told her. When he entered the chamber in the cellar, Ocutus saw a shadowy figure back in one of the corners. It was robed and hooded, and its face glowed green. She drew in her breath sharply. "Could Azash have more than one seeker out there?" Sparhawk asked.
"With an elder god, anything is possible."
"It couldn't be the same one," he said. "Nothing can be in two places at the same time."
"As I said, dear one, with an elder god, anything is possible."
"Sophronia," he said in a strained voice, "I hate to say it, but all this is beginning to frighten me just a little."
"And me as well, dear Sparhawk.
Keep the spear of Aldreus close to you. The power of Belion may protect you.
Now go to bed, I need to think."
"Will you bless me before I sleep, little mother?" he asked, dropping to his knees. He suddenly felt like a small, helpless child. He gently kissed her palms.
"With all my heart, my dear one," she replied,
enfolding his head in her arms and drawing him to her.
"You are the best of them all, Sparhawk," she said to him, "and if you be but strong, not even the gates of hell can prevail against you."
As he rose to his feet, Flute slid down off her bed and gravely came to him. He felt suddenly unable to move. The little girl took him by the wrists in a gentle grasp that he was powerless to resist. She turned his hands over and gently kissed each of his palms, and her kisses burned in his blood like holy fire. Shaken, Sparhawk left the room without a further word. He slept fitfully, waking often and stirring uneasily in his bed. The night seemed interminable, and the rumble of thunder shook the very foundations of the castle. The rain the storm had brought with it clawed at the window of the room in which Sparhawk tried to sleep, and water ran in torrents from the slate roof to hammer the stones of the courtyard. It must have been well past midnight when he finally gave up. He threw off his blankets and sat moodily on the edge of the bed. What were they going to do about Bavier? He knew that the Arshan's faith was strong, but the Cyrenic knight did not have Ocuda's iron will. He was young and ingenuous, and he had the native passion of all Arshans. Belina could use that to her advantage. Even if Sophronia could rid Bavier of his obsessive compulsion, what guarantee would there be that Belina could not reimpose it upon him at any time it pleased her? Although he shrank from the idea, Sparhawk was forced to admit that the course Ocuda had suggested might be the only one available to them. Then, quite suddenly, he was almost overcome by a sense of dread. Something overpoweringly evil was nearby. He rose from the bed, seeking his sword in the darkness. Then he went to the door and opened it. The hallway outside his room was dimly lit by a single torch. Curic sat dozing in the chair outside Bavier's room, but otherwise the hallway was empty. Then Sophronia's door opened, and she came hurrying out with Flute directly behind her.
"Did you feel it too?"
"Yes. Can you locate it?" She pointed at Bavier's door.
"It's in there."
"Curic," Sparhawk said, touching his squire's shoulder. Curic's eyes came open immediately. "What's the trouble?" he asked. "Something's in there with Bavier. Be careful." Sparhawk unhooked Ocuda's chain, slipped the latch, and slowly pushed the door open. The room was filled with an eerie light. Bavier lay tossing on his bed, and over him hovered the misty, glowing shape of a naked woman. Sophronia drew in her breath sharply.
"Succubus," she whispered.
She immediately began an incantation, motioning sharply to Flute. The little girl lifted her pipes and began to play a melody so complex that Sparhawk could not even begin to follow it. The glowing and indescribably beautiful woman at the bedside turned toward the door, drawing its lips back to reveal its dripping fangs. It hissed at them spitefully, and the hiss seemed overlaid by an insect-like stridulation. But the glowing figure seemed unable to move. The spell continued, and the succubus began to shriek, clutching at its head. Flute's song grew more stern, and Sophronia's incantation grew louder. The succubus began to writhe, screaming imprecations so vile that Sparhawk flinched back from them.
Then Sophronia lifted one hand and spoke, surprisingly in a lean rather than styric. "Return to the place from which you came," she commanded, "and venture forth no more this night." The succubus vanished with a disjointed howl of frustration, leaving behind it the foul odor of decay and corruption.
Chapter 15.
"How did she get out of that tower?" Sparhawk asked in a hushed voice. "There's only one door, and Acuta's got it chained shut."
"She didn't get out," Sophronia replied absently,
her brow creased with a frown.
"I've only seen this happen once before," she added.
Then she smiled a bit wryly.
"We're lucky I remembered the spell."
"You're not making any sense, Sophronia," Curic said. "She was right here."
"No, actually she wasn't. The succubus is not of the flesh. It's the spirit of the one who sends it. Bellina's body is still confined in that tower, but her spirit roams the halls of this melancholy house, infecting everything it touches."
"Xavier's lost, then, isn't he?"
"No. I've at least partially freed him of her influence. If we move quickly enough, I can clear his mind entirely. Curic, go find Okuda. I need to ask him some questions."
"Right away," the squire replied, going out the door. "Won't she come back tomorrow night and infect Xavier again?" Sparhawk asked.
"I think there's a way to prevent that. But I've got to question Okuda to be sure."
"Don't talk so much, Sparhawk. I need to think."
She sat on the bed, rather absently laying her hand on Xavier's forehead. He stirred restlessly.
"Oh, stop that,"
she snapped at the sleeping man. She muttered a few words in Styric, and the young Artian suddenly sank back into his pillow. Sparhawk waited nervously as the small woman pondered the situation. Several minutes later, Curic returned with Okuda. Sophronia rose to her feet.
"Okuda,"
she began, but then seemed to change her mind.
"No," she said almost to herself. "There's a faster way.
Here's what I want you to do.
I want you to think back to the moment you opened that door in the cellar, only the moment when you opened it. Don't dwell on what Bellina was doing."
"I don't quite understand, milady," Acuta said.
"You don't have to. Just do it. We don't have much time."
She murmured briefly to herself and then reached up to touch his shaggy brow. She had to stand on her tiptoes.
"Why are you people all so tall?" she complained.
She kept her fingers lightly on Acuta's forehead for a moment, and then let out an explosive breath.
"Just as I thought," she said exultantly.
"It had to be there. Acuta, where's the Count right now?"
"I believe he's still in that central room, lady. He usually reads for most of the night."
"Good."
She looked at the bed and snapped her fingers.
"Xavier, get up."
The Artian rose stiffly, his eyes blank.
"Curic," she said, "you and Acuta help him. Don't let him fall down. Flute, you go back to bed. I don't want you to see this."
The little girl nodded.
"Come along, gentlemen," Sophronia said crisply. "We haven't much time left."
"Just what exactly are we doing?" Sparhawk asked as he followed her down the hall.
For a small person, she moved very fast.
"There isn't time to explain," she said. "We need the Count's permission to go to the cellar and his presence, I'm afraid."
"The cellar?" Sparhawk was baffled.
"Don't ask foolish questions, Sparhawk."
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.